A drone photographed at a Greek airbase. Casualty figures that now exceed Russia's monthly recruitment capacity. A naval blockade announced in one of the world's most consequential waterways. And the European Union, for the first time in its history, preparing to simulate what it would actually do if one of its members came under armed attack. This is the Briefing Desk. The date is April 20, 2026. What follows is a summary of international developments drawn from sourced reporting. No opinion. No speculation. Only what is known. And who said. We begin where the pressure is most acute, on the battlefields and balance sheets of Russia, where two compounding crises are converging in ways that military analysts say have no clear precedent since the early years of this conflict. Russian forces are sustaining casualties at a rate that, by multiple independent assessments, now exceeds their ability to replace personnel. General Jack Keane, former Vice Chief of Staff of the United States Army and co-chair of the CSIS Future of Land Forces Advisory Committee, has placed Russian losses between 38,000 and 45,000 casualties per month. That figure finds directional support in a separate estimate from U.S. Army veteran Preston Stewart, speaking on the World at Stake channel, who cited 35,000 Russian soldiers killed or seriously wounded in a single month, a figure he attributed to unnamed Defense Ministry discussions. But the most striking data point comes from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky himself. Per official figures cited by the military show, Ukraine recorded 89,000 total Russian troop losses in the first quarter of 2026 alone. During that same three-month window, Russia managed to recruit only 80,000 new soldiers. The arithmetic is straightforward, and from Moscow's perspective, alarming. A net personnel deficit of 9,000 troops. The military show described this as the first time since 2022 that monthly Russian losses have exceeded recruitment capacity. Ukrainian officials, per the same source, have set an even more aggressive target, 50,000 Russian casualties per month by the end of this year. Building on that military picture, the economic indicators tell a parallel story of strain. According to reporting cited by Jason J. Smart's channel, 74 of Russia's 89 administrative regions, roughly 83% of the Russian Federation, were in significant fiscal deficit by the end of 2025. Combined regional debt reached approximately $46 billion. Regional bank borrowing rose approximately 3 times year over year, while regional revenue grew only 4% against spending growth of 9%. Moscow itself ran a deficit of approximately $3 billion, cut 2026 investment by 10%, and reduced municipal staffing by 15% per the same reporting. The energy sector, long the backbone of Russian state revenues, is showing its own fractures. Rosneft revenues fell approximately 19%, and net income fell approximately 73% in the prior year. Chief Executive Igor Sechin, according to the same source, described the situation as a perfect storm. Freight costs to ship Russian oil to India, one of Moscow's primary alternative markets, rose above $20 per barrel, described as approximately 10 times pre-sanctions levels.
More recently, on the night of March 8, 2026, Ukraine launched 754 drones, described by the military show as more than ever before in a single operation, at targets across Russia and occupied territories. Ukraine's new Flamingo long-range missile reportedly struck the Kapustin Yar test range and the Votkins plant. A February 2026 strike hit Russia's missile fuel plant in the Tver region. A March 2026 strike targeted a microchip and missile parts production facility. The logic of these targets is consistent. Ukraine is reaching for the supply chains that feed Russian military production. Russia is responding. Regional authorities in the Leningrad region are forming new air defense units and mobilizing reservists, per reporting cited by the War and Politics 24 channel. Governor Alexander Drozdenko reported 27 drones shot down over the Leningrad region in a single overnight operation and confirmed a fire at the port of Vysotsk. A separate fire broke out at an oil storage facility in Teresk in the Krasnodar region, requiring 224 personnel and 56 units of equipment to contain. Airports in Pskov, Saratov, Penza, Samara, and Ulyanov all activated emergency protocols. Russian sources, per War and Politics 24, claimed 11,211 drones intercepted in March alone, though the channel did not independently verify the figure. On the diplomatic and sanctions front, the U.S. Treasury Department confirmed an extension of a sanctions waiver covering Russian oil shipments already at sea, according to War and Politics 24. The waiver, set to expire on April 11th, has been extended until May 16th. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent had previously stated publicly and unambiguously that his department would not be renewing the general license on Russian oil and would not be renewing the general license on Iranian oil. The extension constitutes a reversal of that stated policy, per the same source. No explanation for the reversal was cited in the available reporting. On the territorial map, the data from the Institute for the Study of War, cited by the military show, tells a story of slowing Russian momentum. Russian forces were gaining in excess of 200 square miles of Ukrainian territory per month at multiple points in early 2026. That figure fell to approximately 50 square miles in February 2026. In that same month, Ukrainian forces recaptured more territory than they lost, described as the first such occurrence in years. Over the full calendar year of 2025, Russia gained less than one.
On the diplomatic track, the World at Stake analyst described U.S.-Iran negotiations as proceeding between a first round held the weekend prior to recording and an anticipated second round in Islamabad. The Trump administration sought, in the first round, full Iranian surrender of its nuclear program for a period of 20 years and Iranian concessions on ballistic missiles. Stewart assessed that Iran's 10-point negotiating plan is unfavorable to the United States, that the U.S. 15-point plan represents a clear American victory if accepted, and that the actual outcome is likely to fall somewhere between those two positions. Both sources acknowledge the negotiations remain unresolved. President Trump also announced a naval blockade of the Strait of Hormuz and Iranian ports, per the World at Stake analyst. Former U.S. Admiral James Stavridis was cited on the same channel as assessing that enforcing such a blockade would require a minimum of approximately 20 vessels, 6 destroyers inside the strait, and 2 aircraft carrier groups comprising roughly 14 additional vessels positioned outside. The analyst noted that the 2 American destroyers present at the time of Trump's announcement were engaged in mine detection and removal operations, not blockade enforcement. The gap between the announcement and the operational posture required to enforce it was left unaddressed in official statements. Segment 5. CSIS and the Future of U.S. Land Forces. The Center for Strategic and International Studies has launched a formal study initiative designated The Future of Land Forces, a response, in the words of CSIS President John Homrey, to what he described as a recurring policy bias in American strategic thinking toward air and naval capabilities, particularly in Pacific strategy. Homrey's framing was direct. Airplanes and ships create political dynamics. Land forces create political reality. The study is led by Jerry McGinn, director of the CSIS Center for the Industrial Base, with General Jack Keane serving as co-chair of the advisory committee. Keane's assessment of the current environment was unambiguous. This is, in his view, the most challenging strategic moment the United States has faced since World War II. He attributed this to a deliberate collaboration among Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea that he said began approximately 4 to 5 years ago, when those actors concluded the United States was vulnerable, based on perceptions of atrophied military capability and domestic leadership challenges. On the much-debated question of drone warfare and its implications for ground forces, Keane pushed back against what he described as a popular misreading. The impression that drones render large armies unnecessary, he argues, is drawn incorrectly from the Ukraine conflict, a theater where Ukrainian forces fight primarily at company and battalion level without the enabling brigade, division, and corps echelons that characterize how the United States actually conducts operations. Countermeasures to drone swarms are in development, and combat vehicles will likely carry onboard counter-drone capabilities, per CSIS. Keane also offered a perspective on the human capital dimension that resists easy quantification. It takes 18 years to develop a battalion commander within the Army system, he noted. It takes 14 years to develop a platoon sergeant. These are not positions that can be surged into existence through emergency measures. On the question of strategic deployment against peer adversaries, Keane stated that the uncontested force buildup of the kind conducted during the First and Second Gulf Wars is no longer feasible. China, he argues, can conduct cyber attacks on mobilization, rail movement, shipping, and airlift, and can contest transit kinetically before U.S. forces reach a theater. He identified the First and Second Island chains, running from Japan through Taiwan and the Philippines to Malaysia, and including Guam, as key terrain in any Pacific confrontation, and cited China's construction of artificial islands from South China Sea reefs as evidence that control of land determines control of navigation routes. Segment 6. The Arctic. Sovereignty, Resources, and the Lomonosov Ridge. Beneath the Arctic Ocean, a geological formation is quietly driving one of the most consequential territorial competitions of the coming decades. The Lomonosov Ridge is a subsea mountain range discovered by Soviet researchers in 1948. It runs approximately 1,800 kilometers near the North Pole at a depth of around 1,700 meters, bisecting the Arctic Ocean, according to the Caspian Report. Why does it matter? A U.S. Geological Survey assessment cited by the Caspian Report estimates that approximately 22% of the world's undiscovered crude oil and natural gas is located within the Arctic Circle. The Caspian Report notes that extraction is not currently economically feasible at prevailing oil prices, but the claims being filed now are about the future, not the present.
Russia filed its first Arctic continental shelf claim in 2001. It was rejected for insufficient evidence. A second claim in 2015 supported a territorial assertion covering 1.2 million square kilometers. In March 2023, the UN Continental Shelf Commission declared the outer limit of the Lomonosov Ridge geologically similar to Russian continental territory, but explicitly stated this did not settle Russian sovereignty. Russia has not waited for legal resolution to build presence. It maintains more than 40 military installations along its Arctic coastline, bases, airfields, radar sites, and deepwater ports, and is developing the Northern Sea Route along that coast. Its icebreaker fleet comprises 45 vessels, 37 diesel-electric, and 8 nuclear-powered, per the Caspian Report. Canada filed an initial continental shelf claim in 2013 but withdrew it as insufficiently ambitious, submitting a broader claim inclusive of the North Pole in 2019. That claim remains in procedural limbo. Denmark submitted its claim in 2014, asserting that the entire Lomonosov Ridge is a geological continuation of Greenland, with a legal claim covering approximately 900,000 square kilometers, roughly 20 times the land area of Denmark itself. The Kasangin report makes a structural observation about the Trump administration's stated interest in acquiring Greenland that is worth hearing directly. The United States is geometrically excluded from North Pole shelf claims originating from Alaska alone. Acquiring Greenland would mean inheriting Denmark's existing Arctic continental shelf claims. The report also notes that approximately 40% of Canada's territory lies within the Arctic Circle, and that Greenland's internal politics have shifted toward resource nationalism, a development that threatens the foundation of any Danish claim and complicates the logic of acquisition by any outside party. Segment 7. European Security. Article 42.7, and diplomatic currents. The European Union is preparing to do something it has never done before, simulate what its mutual defense clause actually means in practice. According to Politico reporting cited by War and Politics 24, the EU is planning its first tabletop exercise to test Article 42.7 of the EU Treaty, the clause that obligates member states to provide aid and assistance to any member facing armed aggression. EU Foreign Policy Chief Kaja Kallas is expected to oversee the exercise next month.
A senior EU official told Politico that the aim is to assess the bloc's political rather than military response. That distinction matters. Article 42.7 does not specify whether military action is required and contains specific provisions relevant to neutral countries such as Austria and Ireland. The exercise was partly prompted by Cyprus, which, per War and Politics 24, was targeted in March by drones launched from Lebanon and has pushed for closer examination of what the clause actually obligates member states to do. An EU leader summit is scheduled in Cyprus the following week. More broadly, the picture of European engagement in the Ukraine conflict has evolved significantly. The World at Stake analyst cited a 90 billion euro EU loan to Ukraine as an example of European-led support operating independently of Washington. Zelensky's recent tour of Gulf states was described by the same analyst as part of a broader Ukrainian diplomatic realignment, an effort to build relationships and leverage beyond the transatlantic framework. Zelensky was cited as stating that Ukraine is capable not only of defending itself, but of becoming an exporter of military technology. U.S. military assistance to Ukraine, meanwhile, is described by the same analyst as now close to zero compared to 2022 and 2023 levels. Stewart, on the same channel, assessed that this has diminished U.S. leverage in any negotiation with Kyiv, a point that carries implications for any eventual diplomatic process. On a smaller but symbolically resonant note, Poland's Swimming Federation announced it will not permit athletes from Russia and Belarus to compete in the European Swimming Championships scheduled to take place in Poland. The decision came in response to World Aquatics lifting sanctions and allowing Russian and Belarusian athletes to return to international competitions under their national flags, per Polish radio cited by War and Politics 24. Poland stated it does not plan to boycott other competitions, explicitly to avoid penalizing its own athletes. It is a small story, but it illustrates how the fault lines of this conflict continue to run through institutions far beyond the battlefield. Let us draw these threads together. The most significant development across this briefing is structural. For the first time since this war began, Russia is losing soldiers faster than it can replace them. That is not an assessment from Kyiv. It is arithmetic derived from figures that include Ukrainian government data and independent military analysis. Whether that deficit widens or closes depends on recruitment, mobilization, and the pace of Ukrainian strikes. All three are contested variables. The economic picture compounds the military one. 83% of Russian regions in fiscal deficit, a labor shortage approaching 2 million people. Rosneft's net income down 73%. These are not sanctions projections, they are reported outcomes. The question is not whether these pressures are real, it is whether they translate into strategic change and on what timeline. In the Middle East, U.S.-Iran negotiations are underway, but the distance between positions, a U.S. 15-point plan described as a clear American victory if accepted, and an Iranian 10-point plan described as unfavorable to the United States, suggests the second round in Islamabad will be consequential.
the presence of what analysts assess as the RQ-180 at Larissa adds a layer of operational context that official silence has done nothing to clarify. In Europe, the Article 42.7 simulation is a signal worth reading carefully. The EU is not preparing for a contingency it considers remote. It is preparing because the contingency is no longer considered remote. The distinction between assessing a political response and an operational one is for now deliberate, but the fact that the exercise is happening at all speaks to a transformed security environment. And beneath the Arctic Ocean, a geological formation discovered by Soviet researchers nearly 80 years ago is now the subject of competing national claims that will shape resource access, navigation rights, and military positioning for decades. The legal process is slow, the military building is not. This has been the Briefing Desk. All claims in this briefing are attributable to named sources as cited. We return when the record requires it.